Welcome to the Red Letter Christians podcast. Red Letter Christians gets our name from the Bibles that highlight the words of Jesus in red. And we're aspiring to live as if Jesus meant the stuff he said. We know that the loudest, most prominent voices representing Christianity in America haven't always been the most beautiful or the most faithful voices. And we know that the way we change the narrative is by changing the narrators. We are committed to amplifying the voices of people who are dedicated to Jesus and to justice. How much longer will
justice? Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening in. This is Shane Claiborne, and we're doing this radio show podcast every week. I'm in the middle of fatherhood, so at the beginning of this year, I had a little baby boy, Elijah Allen Claiborne, and that keeps me up at night. But we're trying to put out some new shows every week with dear friends, and there's a lot happening in the world right now, and every week, we're trying to connect our faith to the world that we live in. So our faith doesn't just become a ticket into heaven and an excuse to ignore the world that we live in right now. Many of you that listen are Christians, but there's also people of a lot of different faiths, people of conscience that don't really adhere to any particular faith. One of the things I think of that Jesus said was there was a point where Jesus's disciples said to him, there's this guy down the street that's doing all kinds of miracles and prophecies, but he's not one of us. Should we tell him to stop? And Jesus said, rebukes him and says, no, if he's not against us, he's for us. You get the sense that Jesus is always bringing in people to the movement of love and compassion and is challenging the chosen. As Sister Joan Chittister says, the self-righteous religious elite, he's challenging those folks, and he's always including the excluded, inviting those in the margins. And when it comes to the work of peace and justice, it's beautiful to see folks that are working outside the silos of, the homogenous silos of our own faith traditions, of our own politics. And two friends that have been doing this work that I admire and have been collaborating with every chance we get are the guests on the show today. Ariel Gold from Fellowship of Reconciliation. What up, sister? We've hung out a lot this year. And a new friend, Jim Zogby, Dr. James Zogby, who is the founder of Arab American Institute and a bunch of other stuff, has a number of honorary doctorates, a really public figure here in the U.S. And we just had a summit together a dozen or more organizations, right, collaborated on to respond to the escalating violence in the Holy Land and particularly the genocide in Gaza. So I missed that because of my new little baby. But I wanted for everybody to hear what happened in Chicago a little over a week ago and to hear a little bit more about these two wonderful friends. So, Ariel, why don't you start us out? You've been on the show before and give people a little bit more backdrop, Fellowship of Reconciliation, the oldest interfaith peace and justice organization out there and doing amazing work. So thanks for joining me.
So the Fellowship of Reconciliation, we formed in 1914 in Europe and then 1915 in the U.S. to support conscientious objectors at that time to World War I. And, I was thinking about it today because I was talking with somebody about the first conscientious objector to refuse to fight in the war in Gaza. And I was thinking, other than the Vietnam War, it has never been popular to refuse enlistment. And so in World War I, Jane Addams, who worked for us at the time, she was a pacifist and very against the First World War. And she was really unpopular for that. And then later went on to win the Nobel Prize. We now have 50 branches in countries across the world. And here in the U.S., since the civil rights movement, we have long worked on racial justice. And Martin Luther King was one of our members. And so when Jim called me up, and I go wherever Jim goes, but when he called me up and he said, we're going to work on something for Gaza with Reverend Jesse Jackson, I was immediately in. And I want to hand it off to him because he really was the spark behind it and all through. But Jim.
Thanks, Ariel. And thanks, Shane, for this. We met actually a number of years ago. We didn't meet, but we were together on a panel. You were virtual and I was in person on Palestine with Mitzri Rahib, and Tony was there. And that was first time I'd heard you. And I said, "Ooh, I like this guy." I like
you too.
I worked with Reverend Jackson from the 70s on, his first couple trips to the Middle East. And then in 83, we'd had a problem as Arab Americans because we were supportive of Palestinian rights. We suffered from political exclusion. The political party, Democrats, wouldn't meet with us. Contributions were returned. Candidates gave us a hard time and it wouldn't accept our endorsements even. And it was a painful period. So Jackson came to me in 83. I was running a group called the Anti-Discrimination Committee at the time. I'd founded that in 1980. And he said to me, I need you to come work with me in the campaign. And I said, I've been organizing Arab Americans for 4 years. I can't stop. He said, you'll do more for your community in the next 4 months than you've done in the last 4 years. And he was right. It was so exciting for Arab Americans to have somebody come and speak to them, somebody come and recognize them, somebody come and talk about Palestinian rights. As he put it then, Palestinian justice and Israeli security are two sides of the same coin. You can't have one without the other. So as this crisis unfolded in Gaza, he would call me periodically to want to do something. And then I thought, this is an emergency and we ought to do a summit. We ought to bring together the what we could find of the remnants of the 80s movement and also forces that have come together around peace and justice issues, the progressive Jewish movements that exist, the Black Lives Matter folks, the younger folks, and new elements in the Black church and in the white denominational church and evangelicals. And so we began to assemble this, and Ariel was instrumental in bringing some of the people to the table. And in my office, Maya Berry just worked tirelessly to make sure that all the pieces fit. And it did. It did. Mm. We were almost undone by a snowstorm in Chicago where everything was shut down. But we still had a couple hundred people coming, and we still had thousands watching us virtually.
Yeah, and for folks that missed, tell us, you know, how folks can, you can watch the recordings of it, right?
Yeah, you can. You can either write me at jzogby@aaiusa.org, or you can write Ariel and she'll give you her email, because it's on the FOR site and it's also on the AAIUSA site. But we have clips of those speeches and some of the resolutions that we considered. The call was clear: ceasefire, more humanitarian aid and reconstruction aid for Gaza, and conditioning U.S. assistance to Israel so that the wealth of the American people, the treasure of the American people, isn't used in ways that are destructive of both human life and violative of international law and U.S. human rights law. The consensus that formed around this was just wonderful to see, and created a dynamic that is still unfolding. Today, Minneapolis passed a ceasefire resolution. The mayor of Chicago spoke about ceasefire. We have cities across the country doing it. And it's really quite I think it's important, because this issue of Gaza is something I've not seen before. I've been doing this work for 50 years and I've always been on the opposition of things, you know, and the demonstrations were 50 people in front of the White House. And now there's this spontaneous eruption, yeah, almost like the Black Lives Matter movement, almost like the guns, the student rallies. It's been young people. It's been progressive Jews. It's been Black, Asian, Hispanic. It's been Arabs, obviously. Welcome and Muslims, and very exciting to see. And what we're able to do is bring together leadership from that to a summit to talk about planning the next steps to expand it. And we're already, like I said, seeing the fruits of that expansion play out. The administration is opposed to a ceasefire for inexplicable reasons.
Inexplicable.
But yeah. The base of the Democratic Party is clearly moving in that direction. And what is important to see is that every one of those earlier movements, from the women's to the guns to the Black Lives Matter, they've always been partisan, Democrats versus Republican. This is different because it's within the Democratic Party challenging the party establishment, saying, you can't do this anymore. Our values do not comport with what is happening in Gaza, and people are acting on it.
Yeah, and so in Chicago, not only did you have Reverend Jesse Jackson, who I've actually been able to march with over the last few years. I think we even, you know, did a little direct action, went to jail, can neither confirm nor deny that in D.C., But, you know, and you also had Dr. Cornell West. I mean, Freddie Haynes. These are like, you know, incredible friends and allies, heroes of ours that we work with all the time at Red Letter Christians. But there were people of a lot of different faiths too, right, Ariel? And part of what I think we see right now is that religion can often be twisted and used to justify horrific violence. I mean, no one kills with the passion with which someone does it when they believe that God is on their side. And Jewish folks have done that. Muslim folks have done that. Christians have done that for centuries. But we also see folks pulling out the best of their faith and countering that narrative. And I would love for you, especially as, you know, the first Jewish grounded leader of Fellowship of Reconciliation, to talk a little bit about where you see that too, you know, this kind of interfaith collaboration for peace and ceasefire.
Well, the central concept of Judaism is that we are all, is that to save a life is to save the world entire. And in fact, I think it was the great sage from the first century who said, you know, to do good and to do good for humanity. That's the whole of the Torah. Like, you can read it right. That's all it means. And, you know, yet we have this, I've been saying to my staff, these are the times that define us, right? If Israel, Palestine, if the Holy Land is holy for me, if it's holy for all of us, and this is happening there, if a genocide is happening there, and what we do now, this is what, you know, the mark we leave. And Jews, we've had for 70 years now, we've had a state over there that claims to speak for us, that claims to be our voice, and is now carrying out the most heinous crimes. And thankfully, here in the U.S., you know, there has been this huge outpouring of Jews saying not in our name. And I just want to give so much respect to Rabbi Brant Rosen, who runs the only anti-Zionist brick and mortar congregation in the U.S. in Chicago. And he was ostracized in 2014 when he, you know, made the choice to follow his conscience and do the work that he's doing. But he, you know, it's just this prophetic voice. And it's not just Judaism that is twisting our sacred texts as an excuse for killing, right? So we've got, you know, all through Israel, you know, twisting of text to justify this genocide. But it's aligned with the evangelical movement here in the U.S. And, you know, it's always kind of funny to me why Jews would be so welcoming of that, because that's often as well some of the most anti-Semitic movements in the U.S. But that's what hatred can bring together. And yet at this time, you know, this Saturday, January 27th, is International Holocaust Remembrance Day. And, you know, we as Jews, we have experienced what it's like to be told that if we relocate, then we'll be kept safe and then murdered. We know, you know, those lies. We've seen the beginnings and then, you know, the carrying out of genocide before in front of the entire world. And here it is happening again by us. And, you know, where does this, you know, how do we act on behalf of God right now in this time? And it was incredible to be at the summit with such folks as Wes Granberg Michelson, who just, you know, from an evangelical perspective, and this coming together of a variety of faiths and cultures and saying, you know, this is not in our name and not in the name of our God.
Yeah, right. And Jim, you want to, like, before we talk, I want us to be sure to talk about things on the horizon that we'll be organizing around and next step. But any highlights for those of us that missed the Chicago summit? I know there was a powerful moment with Reverend Jackson and many more than a moment, really a whole weekend of powerful moments. But any highlights you want to point out?
Let me go back to the Reverend Jackson, because I've been close to him for, like I said, for decades and decades now. And Parkinson's has taken a terrible toll on him and his ability to speak. And yet something clicked. He was so excited that he began to speak. at one point got the microphone and began to speak. And I had not heard him do that in months and months. And his children got emotional about it. We all got emotional about it. And his final words to me as I was leaving, I stopped over because I had to run to get a plane. And I said, I said, I want to say goodbye, Reverend. And he said, remember, the babies are dying every day. And I took that with me. And to me personally, that was a highlight, hearing Reverend speak and then his final words to me. But there, I think one of the old timers who'd been with Reverend from the very beginning, Reverend Dwight McKee, was really quite powerful. There was a conversation between Peter Beinart and Mark Lamont Hill that talked about the efforts to silence people who have a view about ceasefire, about Israel's behavior toward Palestinians, and their exchange. It was interesting because they're such professionals, the two of them, that we had a problem with some of the technical issues and we could not hear them. We were going to ask them questions, but they simply ended up conversing with each other in front of all of us and having a marvelous exchange. She mentioned, Ariel mentioned Wes Michelson, who is a prophetic voice always, and his remarks were stunning, as were Brant Rosen's. I think those were some of the key highlights of the weekend. Profound Christian tradition, profound Jewish tradition, both in dialogue with each other, and then Mark and Peter.
Those were some of the key. Good.
Yeah,
Ariel, I want to hear from you too. But also, like, we've been together a few times. We've had a chance to write this ceasefire song, and we've played it on the radio and the podcast. We've been trying to, you know, organize a bunch of different things. I just got off of a call earlier where we're now sending. It blew my mind. I was hoping we could raise $10,000, and we raised $150,000 almost for groups that are working on the ground in Gaza. And I think of Isaac's sermon when he said Gaza has become the moral compass of the world right now. And I mean, I think that we're recognizing that there's a lot of things happening. I mean, even as we're recording this, there's an execution happening. There's all kinds of different issues. But if we can't respond to a genocide being live streamed, that's being funded and backed, and any ceasefire resolution being blocked by the United States, then it seems like we've really fallen short of Dr. King's line that we should be the conscience of our nation, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it baffles me. I sometimes wake up in the middle of the night and I am just baffled at how ceasefire is controversial. like seriously, we're not calling, we have got lots of long-term plan things that we could call for, but we're just staying like, just stop the bloodshed, just stop the bloodshed, right? And so somehow that's controversial. And I guess on the flip side of that, it gives us a moment to have moral clarity, right? At this, because it is so simple, right? There, it's just stop the bombings, stop the bloodshed, stop killing people right now. And that alone, I think, becomes, you know, its own prophetic voice. And we do see that growing, that call growing. So, you know, we had the Chicago mayor, and I'll just give you a little preview that one of the things that FOR is going to be convening as a follow-up from the summit, and we're going to be asking you to partner with us at Red Letter Christians, is taking these city ceasefire resolutions and adapting them for houses of worship and denominations and doing that same work. So just as we've got mayors coming out for ceasefire, we want this church on this corner and that church and this denomination. So that's some of the work that we're going to be digging into. And I'll say, I'm a campaigner. Like, that's kind of my nature. I'm an activist and a campaigner. And I had felt a bit stuck on, like, what's the next, you know, thing to do. And being there with such brilliant minds, and Wes Michelson's going to be working with us on this, that, you know, came through for me. Like, okay, this is a next move forward.
Go ahead. Yeah,
totally. I just want to come in on two things that Ariel said. One about the inexplicability of calling for ceasefire, and it reminds me of Dan Berrigan used to say that the moments of crisis are when 2 + 2 = 4 and is no longer recognized as 4. When you have to say it is 4, it's not 5, it's not 3, it's 4. It's that simple. So in conversations I've had with people in the administration, I leave just baffled. I said to one of them, a really top figure in the administration, Nation. I said something about the a ceasefire, and he said that's intolerable because it would simply mean Hamas rearms, and we can't let that. They have to be eliminated. And then a little while later in the conversation, I said we're up to 7,000 people dead. That's how low it was then. 7,000 civilians dead, and that's horrible. And we're seeing infrastructure destroyed. And he said, and that's intolerable. I said, in other words, there's two intolerables, but you've picked the one that's going to cost lives, not the one that will save lives. And he looked at me baffled. And to me, it was rather simple. And then they talk about, we don't want a ceasefire, but we want humanitarian aid. But you can't do humanitarian aid because people can't get it. The trucks don't come in. And when people go to the area where the aid is, they get bombed. It is genocide. And the U.S. response to the genocide charge is that it's meritless. Mm. I don't know what they're looking at or what they're smoking while they're looking at it, but they're not seeing the same reality that we see unfolding every day. There is no respect for Palestinian human life. And that to me is, in a nutshell, the tragedy. The 100th day, the administration sent out a statement all about the hostages. 100 days, they said hostages, and it's terrible. We mourn for their families. We weep for them. And I do too. But at that point, there were 22,000 dead, and they could not bring themselves even to say a word that in 100 days, that's how many people had died. And it can only be that when Biden said in the beginning of his administration that he valued the equal worth of Palestinian and Israeli lives, there's been a deflation of Palestinian lives. They're like 1 to 20 right now, 20 whatever. And I just don't understand how we can't get them to see the hypocrisy of their concerns when they don't address them in that way.
Yeah. And for folks just listening in, my friends, my guests today on the show are Jim Zogby and Ariel Gold from Fellowship Reconciliation and Arab American Institute. And we're talking about the summit, the ceasefire summit that just happened in Chicago. But even more than just that powerful summit, what we can concretely be doing to, as Jesus said, blessed be the peacemakers. And as Martin Luther King said, those of us that love peace have got to be as organized as those who love war. So we're trying to organize and to build this movement that has been going a long time, but that right now is responding to the escalating violence in Gaza and increasingly in the West Bank as well. So I don't know, I think when we raised just kind of in 2 weeks, raised $150,000, like from people, there was this ground surge. We see marches in the streets with thousands, in some places, hundreds of thousands of people. People want to respond. And I'd love to hear from both of you, Ariel, first. You know, what are some ways that people can respond right now? And what are some things that we'll be doing in the next few weeks that give people an opportunity to step up and be peacemakers?
Sure. Well, we're going to ask Red Letter Christians to start sending out stuff around getting your house of worship or your community center, whatever it is, to call for a ceasefire. And I want to say in the meantime, something that everyone can do, and you can just do this on social media, is there's the first conscientious objector in during the Gaza war. He's a young man, Tal Mitnick. He's just been sentenced this week to his second 30-day sentence, after which they'll take him out and ask him if he's learned his lesson and is ready to kill yet. For sure, he will say no. So lift him up on social media. You can just Google that, Tal Mitnick, Israeli refuser.
Yeah, and when I was over there, I saw the Israeli refusenik, soldiers that were, refusing to carry out orders. That's been happening for a while. It's so encouraging to see it. Jim, any last words as you continue to mobilize?
One is a little work, and that is write to me at jzogby@aaiusa.org. We have a petition that is being signed started by Jewish Voice for Peace, but being signed by state legislators and by city council people. Go to your city council person and ask them to endorse it personally. The second thing is, and this is an easy one, in your community, there are Palestinian organizations. They're in need. They're hurting. Just reaching out to them and say, I understand. And is there anything I can do to help you personally would be so important so that they don't feel isolated in this time of absolute despair that many of them are feeling.
So good. Well, a half hour flies by with two wise, wonderful friends like these. So thanks for tuning in, everybody. Support your local revolution for peace and support those organizations that are organizing right where you are. And continue to follow Ariel Gold, Fellowship of Reconciliation, and Jim Zogby. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Shane.
Cool. So let's just do one more thing. I don't know, that'll end the radio show, but do you have any thoughts on the South Africa and the International Criminal Court? Is this, it seems like this is a moment where this thing has teeth and legitimacy, or the state of Israel and the state of the United, or the United States are more powerful.
It's not the criminal court. It's the International Court of Justice. They're two separate.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Well, talk a bit about that. Why is this important?
I would suggest that you, and we can send your, maybe Ariel, you can send him the link of the closing arguments by the Irish jurist who presented the case. It's a 30-minute video. If you put the link up and told people to go watch it, it is absolutely, absolutely stunning. And it is critical. I mean, if tomorrow they release their preliminary findings, which...
not quite preliminary findings. They announce the decisions on the what's it called, measures. And there's two things that'll get decided. One is demanding Israel let humanitarian aid in, as the other is demanding a halt to the hostilities.
Yeah. And then the final judgment comes
on genocide for at least like a month.
Right. But it's the preliminary findings on whether or not there is to be it's like an injunction. It's a call for an injunction.
Restraining order. It's a restraining order.
Yeah. The bully. But it's an important, if they make that call, it would be a huge, I think, boost to the effort for a ceasefire. If they don't make the call, I think it'll be a huge setback. I can't imagine them not doing it, given this case that was presented. The 1 30-minute speech that she gave was just devastating and just powerful to listen to.
And good God, you know, how isolated the U.S. will be again with this, you know, and here's Biden's next opportunity to say, all right, well, that's finally, that's finally a step too far. Now I'm going, but
I'm not partisan. I don't endorse candidates. I take a lot of my cues from the Catholic worker tradition, the Berrigan brothers. Actually, Phil Berrigan was here, Jim, and I met Dan quite a few times. I actually fire breathed at Dan Berrigan's birthday party one year. So that was my job, was to bring out my circus skills. Nothing holy or prayerful, just the fire breathing was my job. But those are inspirations for me. And, you know,
what the Holy Spirit did on
there
Pentecost.
We go. Yeah. I mean, I believe in some fire breathing, let me tell you. But I just feels, it's baffling the damage that this seems to be doing to the Democratic Party. And I don't know if you want to say anything more, you know, about, because I know you've had a lot of kind of vested energy into that. You said no one can make any sense of like why we're blocking ceasefire resolutions, why we're funding this war.
It's going to take a toll in this election. It's taking a toll in fragmenting the party. The party gave up on white working class voters a generation ago, and it was a tragedy in Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin, factory towns that lost their jobs and mining towns that lost their jobs. Party stopped talking to them, and we focused instead on what has come to be known as the Obama coalition, young people, Black, Latino, Asian, etc. They're now losing them. And that is, I think, a real danger in this election. And for the cohesion of the party, that we're having young people saying, I can't do this. I can't support this anymore. And I, having done this literally all my life, I never thought I'd get to the point where I would be hearing people saying, I can't vote for Democrats because of this issue. I've heard them say, I can't vote for Democrats because of this issue or that issue, whatever. Never thought it would be Palestine that would become the issue. The poll that we did for the summit, we found an extraordinary number, majorities of 18 to 29 and people who were non-white voters saying more than by almost 3-1 margin, young people saying they would be more inclined to support somebody who supports a ceasefire and less inclined to support somebody who opposes a ceasefire. And that's going to take a toll in this election. We're seeing it in New York Times absolutely. Said the same thing. It's a danger.
He can't give a speech. And it's going to be the whole campaign like this. He can't give a speech. It's just disruption after disruption. Was it today or yesterday? The union speech, before that, another one.
Yeah, I saw
and the mayor of Chicago. The mayor of Chicago gives a rip roaring speech equating Black liberation with Palestinian liberation, and Chicago's the host city for the convention.
That's interesting. Wow.
It is an issue within the party. And it's the first time we've been fragmented on an issue, a foreign policy issue, since Vietnam. And we know where that went.
Well, any closing thoughts, Ariel? I think we'll
Yeah, you know, yeah. I said before about things that baffle me. So I just want to say, like, the other thing that baffles me, and this is very much in the Jewish community, there is this false divide between freeing the hostages and stopping the killing of Palestinian children. And it's not actually the families of the hostages, because if you actually listen to the families of the hostages, who actually come from the more liberal progressive area of Israel, but they want a ceasefire. They want whatever it takes. But you know, we have these whole, like, the pro-Israel lobby groups, Anti-Defamation League and AIPAC, they organized a whole huge rally protest for freeing the hostages and not ceasefire. And yet it was only, the only time we've freed hostages is when we stopped dropping bombs for a minute. It's just a, you know, so it's this complete disconnect. And one of the things, you know, one of my, I guess my goals in my community is to somehow get people to realize that and all of our aims are the same, right? Like, there is no, you can't defeat Hamas.
Yeah.
You know, every
I mean, I think that's what we've been putting in everything.
Make
that
a
we
new
put
Hamas.
Out. Yeah, everything that we put out, we said, set the hostages free, cease fire now, let Gaza live, let end the humanitarian aid. And the other thing is, you mentioned Hamas, you know, folks often say, well, what about Hamas? And the difference is, like, I don't know anyone that's defending Hamas and what happened on October 7th. It was wicked. It was evil. And yet Hamas is not our moral standard. You know, that's not like, and the United States is funding this violence in Gaza.
Hamas too. This war is empowering Hamas. In fact, if you look at their ratings, and so say they destroy every single Hamas leader and soldier, every single last one, there's just going to be Hamas 2.0. I mean,
every
we
time,
use no hatred and violence.
Every time we've done this, we went. Israel went to Lebanon in 82 to end the PLO, and they ended up with Hezbollah. We went to Iraq to get rid of Saddam, and we ended up with Iran and ISIS controlling different parts of the country. We tried to go into Afghanistan. I mean, it's like in this era, we do not win wars by killing. We solve problems by negotiating, and we have not gotten that. I mean, last time we won a war, I think, was Grenada. And frankly, it makes no sense. And so I don't understand the Israeli argument or the Americans supporting the Israeli argument. Ariel said Hamas 2.0, it will be more virulent, because when they talk about day after, well, we have to talk about the day after. There is no day after for people, 24,000 people who've been killed and their families. And
all the children without limbs now.
There's a whole new acronym in medical circles for wounded children without any family. That's a whole new thing in
Sweet
Gaza.
Jesus. Yeah.
And those people are not going to be amenable toward peace the day after. And unless we focus on them and focus on ending this so that there's no more of them, no more of them meaning we don't add to the numbers, we're in very deep trouble. And frankly, you know, I think all the time that you've got the spoiled child Israel and the abused child the Palestinians, and what's needed is an adult in the room. But instead, we've chosen to be the coat holder, enabler, and cheerleader for one side, which only aggravates the problem and makes us hated on the one side and taken advantage of on the other side. And the result is that our standing has declined. As a, you know, I would argue we don't have moral standing after everything we've done in Vietnam and Iraq and everything. But even our stated values are now scoffed at around the world. When the UN votes 153-10, and among those 10 are territories that are beholden to us and even have U.S. zip codes in their mail, that's not leadership. Can't be a leader if nobody's following. And right now, nobody's following. We're alone.
Well, yeah, we'll keep this conversation going. Thanks. And you know, just to send us out with the words of Jesus when he said, you live by the sword, you die by the sword. We've seen it true over and over, and we're seeing it in real time. We will not build a better future using the sword. Time to put it away, beat those swords into plows and spears into pruning hooks. So thanks for tuning in, y'all. Thanks, Jim. Thanks, Ariel. We'll talk soon. Bless y'all.
Thanks, Jim.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Red Letter Christians podcast. Too often, Christians have used our faith as a ticket into heaven and a license to ignore the world we live in. But at Red Letter Christians, we believe our faith is not just about going to heaven when we die, but also about bringing heaven to earth while we live. For more information on Red Letter Christians and upcoming events, additional resources, you can go to the show notes, or our website, redletterchristians.org. You can also support Red Letter Christians by giving a one-time donation or becoming a monthly sustainer. Just go to our website and click the red donate button. Thank you for being a part of this conversation and for being a part of this movement.